time for my word. Here is the correct interpretation of events in Iraq today, spoken in English, but not run through the dull and dry translator software of official Washington, D.C. Ready? Here it is, the real meaning of Election Day in Iraq. We won! We won! We won! We won! A little too triumphalist for you? Feeling a little icky that we might say something that bold? You must be suffering from a touch of Euro today. Eat a Big Mac and get over it. We won. It's bold, but it's also true. Now, you don't like saying we won, we won, we won because you think we have not won? That's different. Here's why I say we won. Saddam is on trial. The main point of the war was regime change on Saddam. Believe me, it is changed. When he's on trial for his life, rather than running people through chippers and chopping off limbs to emphasize a political point, I like the sight of Saddam Hussein.
Day by day, all this we won, we won. Man, head coffee business is exploding in West Oakland. How the hell are you winning? But okay, wait. If you won, all right, bring the troops home.
Oh well, we can't do that.
Why not? Why not? You said you won. Bring the troops home.
Well, we still have to find Bin Laden.
Bin Laden's dead. He's been dead for a couple of years. Everyone knows that.
We still have other wars to fight. We still got the war on Christmas.
Bill O'Reilly's taking care of that. Remember here.
Yeah, well, war on illegal immigration.
You're killing up Latinos and building your Chinese wall over here. That war is being fought here. You should know your master in chief is spying on everyone under the sun. Shut the hell up. You won. If this is what you call victory, I hope the market machine has more victories like this. We'll be singing your funeral song very shortly. You know what time it is. Slave time. You're listening to 103.3, 101.1, freakradio.org, Skid and Santa Cruz. 107.5 North Carolina, 104.1 Berkeley, LUVER.com, the world, RadioFraud.net, the universe. Check out the Slave Web, archive and blog, disco, Google Web, Slave Revolt Radio. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to explore who the real enemy of this state is. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth? How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
The global internet became their trading floor. doing. Don't you wish you could pay for everything that bad?
Now things are about to get out of hand. And for people like these, an incredible weapon has been created.
They cannot defend. They have no freedoms that they cannot take. They have no rights of privacy. That they cannot extract. These are not accorded to the slaves. They must be won and taken. Boy George's most recent scandal. No, I'm not talking about him dreaming of blowing up Al Jazeera, or the Downing Street memo scandal, or the uranium Africa Iraq scandal, or the plane gate scandal, or the stolen election part 1 and 2, or the spying on UN members, but spying on citizens in this country. Is something we're going to explore and how it fits in within the corporate media structure in this Ventures in Corporate Media Land segment titled Enemies of the State. So first, let's start off dealing with Boy George as he's talking to Jim Lehrer about the secret wiretaps that he authorized the NSA to be engaged in. So, let's check out what this slob has to say. Dig this.
Secret wiretaps by the National Security Agency of thousands of Americans. Is that true?
Jim, we do not discuss ongoing intelligence operations to protect the country. And the reason why is that there's an enemy that lurks that would like to know exactly what we're trying to do to stop them.
So if, in fact, these things did occur, they were done legally and properly.
So you're trying to get me to talk about a program that's important not to talk about, and the reason why is that we're at a war with an enemy that still wants to attack.
In fact, don't you believe that answer is going to lead people to believe that you're confirming that, in fact, you did this?
We don't talk about sources and methods. We talk about ongoing intelligence operations. I know there's speculation.
But I mean, is it correct to say that the National Security Agency is normally told to do surveillance only on international calls rather than domestic calls,
not without reference to this specific thing? Jim, I know that people are anxious to know the details of operations. People want me to comment about the veracity of the story. The policy of this government is not going to do it. And the reason why is that because it would compromise our ability to protect the people.
You see what's happening here. And the whole Orwellian nature of this dynamic and how the corporate media plays into this whole apparatus while trying to appear at times to be somewhat challenging. It's all a farce. Because when you hear Boy George talk about, we don't talk about our sources and our methods, yet they are spying. But we're not supposed to be privy to how they go about this. If it's even within the confines of their law, is it justifiable by their law? I'm not even talking about real human rights, but their law. He mixes in this, there's an enemy that lurks. And we don't talk about ongoing intelligence operations. These are all things he was saying. Now, you put that in the context with him saying all of this type of stuff, and basically what you get in this whole we're at war with an enemy that wants to attack us rhetoric is that he's engaged, the empire's engaged in this war for our safety. In other words, all of this stuff that is happening, the battle against terrorism, the spying, the propaganda like we went into last week with Pat Buchanan, where Pat Buchanan was justifying deception and everything else manipulative under the sun because the ends justify the means. That's all under the umbrella of a war on terrorism. And it's all for, quote-unquote, our safety. So in this Orwellian world that Boy George and them have constructed, war equals safety. War is safety. This is where we've come to. This is how degenerated the world has become in the way it is filtered through the corporate media lens. This is how, in essence, though, in reality, it's clear. The enemy is us. The slaves are the enemies of the state. And vice versa. All of this, there's an enemy that lurks. But he doesn't disclose, of course, who he's spying on. So, any and everyone could be enemy. But it's justified because war is safety. If you want to be safe, we have to have this war. So you can just see the overlapping Orwellian undertones, overtones, and quicksand-like quagmire this type of stuff leads you in, and how the corporate media, without addressing what these fools are really saying and doing, plays in to the undermining of our own humanity. Now, days later, after Boy George was saying he doesn't discuss this, when they noticed that the population was a little concerned about what the hell are these savages up to, without blinking an eye, and without a little hint of irony by him or the corporate media, Boy George flip-flops, and now he starts talking about the subject. So let's see within what construct he spews out this message.
I'm also using constitutional authority vested in me as commander-in-chief. In the weeks following the terrorist attacks on our nation, I authorized the National Security Agency, consistent with U.S. law and the Constitution, to intercept the international communications of people with known links, to Al-Qaeda and related terrorist organizations. Yesterday, the existence of this secret program was revealed in media reports after being improperly provided to news organizations. As a result, our enemies have learned information they should not have. And the unauthorized disclosure of this effort damages our national security and puts our citizens at risk. Revealing classified information is illegal, alerts our enemies, and endangers our country. The authorization I gave the National Security Agency after September the 11th helped address that problem in a way that is fully consistent with my constitutional responsibilities and authorities. The activities I have authorized make it more likely that killers like these 9/11 hijackers will be identified and located in time. And the activities conducted under this authorization have helped detect and prevent possible terrorist attacks in the United States and abroad. The activities I authorized are reviewed approximately every 45 days. Each review is based on a fresh intelligence assessment of terrorist threats to the continuity of our government and the threat of catastrophic damage to our homeland. During each assessment, previous activities under the authorization are reviewed. The review includes approval by our nation's top legal officials, including the Attorney General and the counsel to the President. I have reauthorized this program more than 30 times since the September the 11th attacks, and I intend to do so for as long as our nation faces a continuing threat from Al-Qaeda and related groups. The NSA's activities under this authorization are thoroughly reviewed by the Justice Department and NSA's top legal officials, including NSA's General Counsel and Inspector General. Leaders in Congress have been briefed more than a dozen times on this authorization and the activities conducted under it. Intelligence officials involved in this activities also receive extensive training to ensure they perform their duties consistent with the letter and intent of the authorization. This authorization is a vital tool in our war against the terrorists. It is critical to saving American lives. The American people expect me to do everything in my power under our laws and Constitution to protect them and their civil liberties. And that is exactly what I will continue to do so long as I'm the President of the United States.
Okay, so here you hear Boy George steeped in more Orwellian quagmire rhetoric. He goes into this stuff about how our enemies have learned information they should not have. This is doublespeak, because in reality, the enemies that he's really talking about is us. Citizens within this slave market order in America, we weren't supposed to hear about this. This is what really has his dandruff up. But see, it's all doublespeak. The mere fact that he's complaining about the unauthorized disclosure and how how it was illegal, yet within his own administration, you have a situation where when they came up against someone who brushed them the wrong way, antagonized them, and undermined their particular agenda on this war in Iraq, i.e. Joseph Wilson, they didn't hesitate to illegally, under their laws, release her name out into the press as punishment for what Joseph Wilson had done. So, here Boy George is talking about the media undermining their war on terrorism and efforts, and undermining their efforts to get information. And here, this Valerie Plame was their CIA operative, whose imperial job was to get information for the empire, yet they willingly threw her out into the garbage bin, which is basically where they all belong, but they openly did it as punishment for what Joseph Wilson did. So if this was really such a thing, these types of things about quote-unquote national security and all of that rhetoric, they wouldn't be leaking on the Valerie Plame any more than they're accusing the corporate media and upping the dandruff about this episode. In reality, is this more smoke and mirror? Because after all, you have a situation where it took the New York Times a damn year. Now, in this year's time, it's not so much of a thing where an election thing, you know, that a lot of people are focusing in on. Of course, that has to do with a certain aspect for people who are involved in electoral. But some of the important real aspects is that now these guys have already intricately put in a web to cast out on its particular subjects. And keep in mind, they're using this rhetoric now about how this was about people who are calling internationally with so-called suspects. But say you become a suspect in the States, are they just going to check you out internationally whenever you make international calls or emails? Of course not. They're going to do it internally within this country under the whole guise of national security. So you're going to have, of course, all types of people, without a doubt, as time goes on, just like it always reveals, that yes, they had an internal espionage type of mechanism going on within this country. But under the whole auspices of war is safety, and they're engaged in this particular war, you keep hearing them say it, war, terrorists, enemies, this just is justified. He commented that, quote, "This is a highly classified program that is crucial to our national security. This is a vital tool in our war against the terrorists. It is crucial to saving American lives." So once again, in that sentence that he's laying out, he's basically saying it's crucial to saving American lives that we're engaged in this. It's a vital tool, and it's a highly classified, so you're not really supposed to know, and it's crucial to our national security, all under the umbrella of a war on terrorism. So since this apparatus is supposed to and is designed under his words to make you safer and maintain your safety, what in essence he's saying, once again, without any challenge by the corporate media, on the real structure of what he is saying, and that is war is safety. Now, how in the hell is war safety? Only in an Orwellian world that has the corporate media structure aligned with it to obfuscate the issues, to put you in a land of gumpified disillusionment for the empowerment of an empire whose beast horns and hooves are becoming more and more prominent as each day goes by. Now here's Condoleezza Rice trying to wipe her master's Boy George behind clean, basically with her tongue. Check this out.
After the September 11th attacks, President Bush secretly authorized the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on Americans and others inside the U.S. to search for evidence of terrorist activity without the court-approved warrants ordinarily required for domestic spying, according to government officials. Why did the Bush administration feel this step was necessary?
Well, Katie, I'm not going to comment on intelligence matters and certainly not on a newspaper story about intelligence matters. I can tell you that the president has always lived within the law. He has always said that he will do everything that he can to protect the American people from the kind of attack that we experienced on September 11th. But within the law and with due regard for the civil liberties of Americans. The Washington Post quotes a woman named Kate Martin. She's the director of the Center for National Security Studies at George Washington University. She said the secret order may amount to the president authorizing criminal activity. She says, quote, "This is as shocking a revelation as we have ever seen from the Bush administration," said Martin, who has been sharply critical of the administration's surveillance and detention policy. "It is, I believe, the first time a president has authorized government agents to violate a specific criminal prohibition and eavesdrop on Americans." Can you comment on that? I can only comment to say that the president has been very clear that he would not order people to do things that are illegal.
So the New York Times says it waited a year to report this because it was asked by the White House not to publish this article because it would be a threat to national security. How would it be a threat, and can you confirm that?
Well, I'm, again, not going to comment on intelligence activities because intelligence activities, by their very nature, are activities that are sensitive and that should not be compromised.
Once again, you can see how sick this whole process is. The corporate media, this Palazan, they just ask a string of words. But they're not really challenging them on anything, and they let them just say anything, quite naturally. The whole point of the whole venture into the corporate media structure is to show how, in part, they play into the Orwellian twist to obfuscate you off real crucial issues and stuff. When Condoleezza Rice says that the president would not order people to do things illegally, and we know about the torture that is going on and continues to go on, the rendering to nations that torture, the conversation that he had concerning his wishing to blow up, bomb Al Jazeera. I mean, this is an outlaw for the capitalist order. But it's all this brushed over. They ask a question. Condoleezza Rice or whoever blows some smoke out of their behind, they just move on. All of this cloak of secrecy that Boy George and them have been involved in, 9/11, the FEMA issues, on and on and on. It just shows how the corporate media apparatus is part of the apparatus of destruction, control, confusion, and how deadly this whole mechanism is. Now next, CNN had on Wolf Blitzer, and on Blitzer's program, he did an interview with two right-wingers. One is Bob Barr, you know, former representative, and another right-winger is Dana Rickenbacker, and they go into the whole spy network. Let's see how this Orwell Dana guy uses the art of deception in his debate with Bob Barr. Check it out.
American spying on Americans. In a story first reported today by the New York Times and confirmed by our own sources here at CNN, President Bush is said to have authorized the super-secret National Security Agency to conduct electronic eavesdropping here at home. The president is saying only that he won't discuss ongoing intelligence operations. Joining us now are two conservative Republicans who have very different views on this issue. From Atlanta, the former congressman and CNN contributor Bob Barr, and from Capitol Hill, California, Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. Congressman Barr, what's wrong with what the president has decided to do?
Well, what's wrong with it is severalfold. One is bad policy for our government to be spying on American citizens through the National Security Agency. Secondly, it's bad to be spying on Americans without court oversight. And thirdly, it's bad to be spying on Americans apparently in violation of federal laws against doing it without court orders. So it's bad all around, and we need to get to the bottom of this.
You agree, Congressman Rohrabacher? I suspect you don't.
What's really bad is the fact that we have an evil opponent who wants to blow us up, and that 6 months after 3,000 of our American citizens were slaughtered right in front of our eyes, that we were confronted with this challenge. I'm really sorry that we have this kind of evil enemy that wants to slaughter us, but I'm very happy that we have a president that 6 months after they slaughtered 3,000 of our citizens, he decided to follow up on a lead that was given to our people by breaking up an Al-Qaeda cell in Pakistan and follow through on that to make sure that there wasn't another imminent attack, and thus probably saving many thousands of American lives. We can be proud of President Bush for protecting us.
Congressman Barr, what do you say?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Constitution is the Constitution, and I took an oath to abide by it. My good friend, my former colleague, Dana Rohrabacher, did, and the president did. And I don't really care very much whether or not it can be justified based on some hypothetical. The fact of the matter is that if you have any government official who deliberately orders that federal law be violated despite the best of motives, that certainly ought to be of concern to us.
9/11 is not a hypothetical.
The hypothetical is the other cases you were talking about.
Now that we are at war, that is not hypothetical. We have an enemy that has decided that they are going to terrorize the American population by committing mass murder. That is not hypothetical. We are at war, and
now what you were saying, Dana, is that there were other cases. Those are hypothetical.
Bob, you haven't read this. No, that's not hypothetical at all. One of the cases that was involved in this was someone who was attempting to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge, and because of these wiretaps,
how do we know
who wasn't deterred from blowing up other targets?
Well, I guess the president should be able to ignore whatever provision in the Constitution, as long as there's something after the fact to justify it. During wartime,
you give some powers to the presidency you wouldn't give in peacetime.
Do we have a declaration of war, Dana?
You don't have to do that. You just have to make sure that the people of the United States understand that we are at war. Oh. They understand that Al-Qaeda slaughtered 3,000 of our citizens, more people than the Japanese slaughtered in Pearl Harbor.
Once again, you can see how wretched these individuals really are. I mean, he was trying to use the art of deception and misleading the listeners on what he was talking about or what Barr was talking about as the conversation was transpiring. First, he outlines how he's proud of Boy George for basically hypothetically, more or less, breaking up some cells and saving many thousands of lives. It's hypothetical because we don't, it's all in secret. And as we slaves know, we know who's involved in many of these processes of orchestration of so-called attacks from Pearl Harbor to the Gulf of Tonkin to 9/11, on and on. But when Barr tries to respond about the hypothetical, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge and all of this type of stuff, then he says 9/11 is not a hypothetical. Well, Barr was obviously not talking about that, and he kept trying to press it until Barr just stuck with it. Then he just degenerates on into saying, during a wartime, the president can do this and that and all of that, even though there's no official declaration of war. I'm talking about within the confines of these law and order types that say that they believe in the system. It shows that they have no regard for anything that does not serve their overall agenda. So, he throws out smoke, like, or how do we know about, we don't know about the people who were deterred. Well, of course, that's just more hypothetical assumptions that he's throwing out there. But see, this is all supposed to be accepted, the erosion of rights, because after all, war is safety. And when Barr confronts him about the aspect of how the mechanisms within the empire are supposed to transpire for an official war, this Dana clown says, you don't have to do that. People understand. So you can see how the whole process, the corporate media, plays in its role of gumpifying, not being crystal clear on the real human rights issues, what they really mean, making it real clear about when these entities are in violation of them, so that when a Dana defecates stuff out of his behind in this way, it can be exposed for what it is. Instead, you have a whole orchestration of what Boy George, Condoleezza Rice, and now Dana are saying about this is a vital tool against the terrorists. It's crucial to saving lives. That was Boy. Dana, during wartime, a president will have more leeway and power, etc., etc. None of this type of stuff is real from the construct of even what they have scribbled down on their little documents. It's only real out of the imperial ferociousness of the state and its disregard of its subjects in this country and around the world, and the apathy of the masses of people within this society. Making it clear, as they goose-step all over the continent and all over the world, that the enemy of the state is us. Put on a set.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do.
Billy Williams was destroyed by the state. We're going to explore certain aspects of that event and some of the players in the progressive, quote-unquote, movement who see themselves in the forefront of making change on these types of issues. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called Tukey Williams, Free at Last? First off, let's hear from Alice Huffman, an NAACP member, outlining her ideas and her opinions about Tukey's assassination. Check this out.
I must tell you, we are deeply saddened by the governor's decision to not grant clemency to Stanley Tukey Williams. We believe this is a serious blow to our efforts to eliminate gangs and to create a safer environment. We believe that Stanley Tukey Williams' life has value above any notion of an eye for an eye, which is the premise of the death penalty. Obviously, the governor believes otherwise. We believe that every child Stanley Williams Tukey is able to draw away from gang life is invaluable. Obviously, the governor does not. We believe that one can reform and become rehabilitated from wherever one resides. Stanley, for the last 10 years, has made a difference in the lives of inner-city children all over the world. We think that the work of his should set the stage for him to be granted clemency, of the permission to continue. Obviously, the governor did not see it that way. The national NAACP, the state NAACP, local branches and youth units, the California Chamber, the Urban League, the ACLU, and many other groups that are opposed to the death penalty, all calling for clemency, were not heard. It is clear that we have no voice and no standing with this governor. We regret that the governor does not understand or care about the injustices of the criminal justice system and the disparities with which we live, that erodes our trust in the system. Even after an inmate has come forth at the 11th hour to provide evidence that Stanley Williams was framed inside the prison, the governor would not listen. I regret that the governor has abandoned the secret canon of redemption. He does not believe that from someone that's bad, a change can come, a new beginning, and that person can be an instrument of good.
Now, what's interesting about this particular comments by Huffman is that it's so out of touch with reality that it's hard to believe that this is by accident. You know, the NAACP used to have its youngest, brightest members become lawyers, who are lawyers, work within the poor regions of Black America, and deal with these types of cases. That way, one, they would get their feet wet on, you know, crucial cases, and two, it would interject them within the community. That stuff takes place no more. The Black poor masses are just left to the viciousness of the state as they're thrown off into the death chambers of incompetent lawyers who are supposed to be there in their defense. Now, these court-appointed lawyers are often the ones with the biggest problems in themselves within the confines of the professional lawyer ranks. Often have alcohol problems, drug problems, just not sharp at all. And the state has their machine on the prosecution side revved up full octane. It is locked in within the police system. They have the control of the evidence. The police gather the evidence. The evidence then comes to the prosecution, to the defense. Now, what the police have done to the evidence, and what it is done, what happens to the evidence through the prosecution, who knows by the time it gets to the defense? Especially these incompetent Ron Mock, Jackson out of Philadelphia types. This is all a sham. Now, if you have energized people in there who are questioning, who are reporting, who are cross-looking over the documents of the police and the prosecution, they can often uncover things that helps expose the state apparatus in its deviousness. But one, the NAACP has historically seen that when they have the youngest, most energetic, brightest of their ranks engaged in these issues, it often radicalizes them. And it radicalizes them to the point where they want to take these issues that are far outside of the bounds that the NAACP wants to go. So it's hard to hold on or control your youngest, brightest people if they're dealing with cases across the country where corporations are using black foster kids as lab rats in New York, where cops are shooting at black suspects while they're in their car unarmed, hundreds of times with bullets ricocheting all throughout the neighborhood, like in Compton, where the police are forced to release over 100 people when their crash unit crashes and burns and exposes itself, where cops are involved in framing up black grandmothers in Philadelphia, Tulia, Texas, etc., etc., etc. See, you can't have even idealistic and green energetic people become involved within the criminal justice system and not have their eyes open. So this is something that they don't engage in anymore. And the fact that they're also a corporate-based institution, in other words, the NAACP survivability is not based off of the community anymore. They get their fundings and all of this type of stuff from corporations, the Texacos of the world. So they're an institution removed from the black experience as far as really truly being involved. Yeah, they could be spokesmen when top people die, Richard Pryor or, you know, Rosa Parks, you know, shuffle around on the church stage, hoop and holler, all that type of stuff. But the real stuff, And that's because they themselves do not want the dynamic of what's going on within the black community to become radicalized. They're there as a fire suppressant agent. Here you have a situation where the NAACP branch of Compton supported Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas, this is when the Negro was trying to become a Supreme Court justice member. Now, anyone who wanted to know about Clarence Thomas' background, it was there for you. For instance, Clarence Thomas was a member of the Lincoln Review with Armstrong Williams. The Lincoln Review was a conservative lobbyist slash think tank type of operation. These Negroes in the Lincoln Review were actually paid spokesmen for the South African apartheid government. They would come out and do speeches on behalf of the white apartheid racist government to make them sound and look not as bad and as ferocious as they really were. This is what Clarence Thomas and Armstrong Williams were doing back in the day. Also, you have a thing where, you know, Clarence Thomas was appointed into the EEOC. And if you had, you know, job complaints, your rights being violated, et cetera, et cetera, you would take it to the EEOC. And Clarence Thomas at the time had already a pamphlet out saying that he doesn't believe in abortion because he believes in the construct of natural law. Since it's unnatural for a woman to have an abortion, it's in violation to its principles concerning natural law. Well, let's see how real that is. Some women were working in the workplace, and they didn't have a proper ventilation system, and they were getting sick, and several of them were pregnant. They were concerned about the baby to be and the baby developing inside them. So they took the complaint to the company and asked them to put in a proper ventilation system. The company said, nah, we're not going to do that. You guys want to work here? Sterilize yourselves. So of course Dave said, nah, these guys are mad. So they took their complaint to the EEOC. Clarence Thomas was the head of it. Clarence Thomas sided with the corporations, saying if the women wanted to continue to work there, they needed to sterilize themselves. Now, under the construct of natural law, that's a contradiction, because if it's unnatural for a woman to have an abortion, it's equally, at the very least, unnatural for a woman to sterilize herself. But that's because in reality, Clarence Thomas is whatever Massa tells him to be. This is the sick entity that the NAACP branch in Compton backed. The NAACP also gave Condoleezza Rice an award. This is a sick, vicious heathen. A Christian heathen. You know, an Abrahamic heathen, because it seems to this kind of go hand in hand with the Abrahamic branch. But whatever the case is, no one in their right mind would give Condoleezza Rice any kind of award of human decency. But now you see where they're coming from. So when they use rhetoric about the death penalty, it's an eye for an eye premise. No, it's not. The whole death penalty mechanism is just part of a state-sponsored terror program. And it used randomness as a tool because, you know, it's less than 1% of the people who actually commit murders are actually charged with capital punishment. So it's just a select few. And the pyramid setup is, if you kill a white person and you don't have much money, is one of the main architects of you being on death row. So take the state of Maryland. You have a situation where in Maryland, 70% of the people on death row are black. 100% of the people on death row killed a white person. Yet black on white homicide, violent homicide, make up less than 1% of the violent crime. So the whole thing is centered around an economic and racial construct. That's beyond just quote-unquote an eye for an eye. That's a random selectiveness that's racially and economically coded. And let's hear what Jesse Jackson had the man pan out about the Tookie situation. Check this out.
Obviously very disappointed that the governor has missed a moment to choose life over death, has missed a moment to choose redemption over revenge. We've seen these last few years 122 people walk off of death row who had been wrongfully convicted. We've seen people whose lives have been turned around in the process. Cookie has made a great contribution, Cookie has, these last few years. And I'm going to hope the governor has seen the opportunity here to expand hope. I hope that recycled despair does not come out in hurtful ways. Cookie certainly discourages any form of violence in reaction to this decision. He feels that any act of street violence would undermine the impact of his teaching of his legacy. He does not want any violent expression or street ugliness to mar his teaching.
Now, no one in their right mind wants unorganized, self-destructive violence by the slaves to be orchestrated. But this is kind of sickening when every time you hear Jackson, you see him defecating out his concern and his polemic about no use of violence. Do not use violence. It's to go against this person's teaching, that person's teaching. King, Tookie, we don't want this ugliness. And what's so sick about it is here you have a situation where Jackson, like many of these progressive, nonviolent perpetrators, are always talking this type of stuff. Yet come election time, I guarantee you, the overwhelming majority of them will be pulling that lever for the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is one of the most violent institutions on the planet. So how in the hell are you an advocate of nonviolence when you support an institution that openly talks about, polemicizes, orchestrates, and uses violence for who they represent? They don't hesitate. The Democratic Party, there's nothing nonviolent about the Democratic Party, and there never has been. And you can't hide behind, this lesser of two evil rhetoric, because in reality, what you're saying is, it's in your little pathetic mind, the Democratic Party is lesser violent than the Republican Party. Well, that's like saying some street member that you're chastising for being in a gang that one subset of Crips is less violent than another subset. So if you choose to be a gang member, being the one that's less violent, since they're the lesser evil. But see how they just play games. This is sick. The Democratic Party is a violent institution. If you support the Democratic Party, You cannot consider yourself in any way an advocate or a practitioner of nonviolence. This hypocrisy has to stop. But see, it's always charlatans like this who are out there preaching this rhetoric to the slaves, like they're on some kind of higher moral ground, when they back an institution that's hands are so bloody that it'll never be washed clean. Now, Jackson also says that he's disappointed because the governor missed an opportunity to choose redemption over revenge. Look, damn it. Capital punishment, as I said, it's beyond revenge. It's a form of a random, selective aggression by the state to demoralize and intimidate by brute force the population. Don't you know that they know that many people know about the large number of people who are wrongly convicted? They're sending you a message. Yeah, we know that 1 out of 8 persons is wrongly convicted. What you gonna do about it? We know that sometimes we quote unquote get it right and sometimes we get it wrong. What you gonna do about it? The death penalty in America has its legacy deeply entrenched in the slave lynchings. The find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro. That method was designed to terrorize the black population into submission. That was a form of collective guilt that all of y'all are criminal. All of y'all are less than human in our eyes and are vulnerable to our wrath if or when we so choose with impunity. It's a way of them letting people know in the past and currently who has the power. So in part, they don't really mind, quite naturally, people pointing out the facts of, how many people have been wrongly convicted and on and on and on. Because they're coming from an intimidation measure. And they know that unless the slaves organize to resist their system, it's goodbye. I mean, anyone who would step back. Look, the average person knew that it was inhuman what the slavers were doing to the black slaves in the American plantations. So the fact that many people knew it wasn't really the issue for the slavers. They, in the end, knew that it was all about power, because they're exploiters, and they're going to justify, of course, their exploitation, but you weren't going to change them by your capacity to bring out the inhumanity of their slave system. What brought chattel slavery in the Americas to its knees was the crushing of the slaver's machine. And that's what's going to take in this next phase of the slave order. Now, Jackson says that his friend the governor missed an opportunity to choose hope. This is about control. And violence is one of their tools. They're not trying to give hope to the slaves. They're trying to create hopelessness within us. Vulnerability, passivity. That's what this is about. Stop all this smoke and mirrors rhetoric. This is the real world. But see, this shows you the charlatan side of Jackson when he talks of all of this madness. You know, in 92, there was a truce between the Crips and the Bloods. And, you know, people in Watts and other surrounding areas within South Central confirmed how gang-on-gang slayings over issues like, you know, region, turf, all that type of stuff, collapsed. At the same time, there was all this rhetoric by the state that they were going to do this urban reconstruction and development, Rebuild LA initiative. They promised $6 billion in investment. They promised to create 74,000 new jobs in 5 years in the riot zone. Years later, the same riot zone, quote unquote, lost 50,000 jobs within that decade. See, these guys are just, they're con persons. Now, within that construct, you have a situation where last year in the LA area, 93,000 people between 18 and 24 were either out of school or out of work. Statewide, the number is 638,000 between 18 and 24 who are out of school or out of work. Now, within this depravity, how does the machine respond? $55 million goes to the LAPD gang suppression efforts, $12 million to prevention programs for little kids, $2 million for intervention programs meant to channel teenagers away from a violent past. They're not trying, quite naturally, to lead the masses of young people on a path other than self-destruction. It's just a smoke and mirrors game that they're playing. And Jackson knows this. So for him to continuously spew out the same rhetoric shows how deprived he is as an individual. Now also within that whole rhetoric, you have a situation where, you know, recently you had or during this whole ordeal, you know, various Crips and stuff, they turned over their weapons to the police as a show of faith and commitment to be on Tukey's path if the governor, in hope that the governor would see that redemptive value and not execute Tukey. This is one of the sorriest episodes in modern Black American experience history. Look, what the hell are you doing turning over your weapons to the state? That doesn't even make any sense. What is some little fat, sloppy Christian preacher or some imam talk you into that with some hocus-pocus rhetoric and stuff on some quote-unquote redemption mode? This is junk. Look, if you've come to your senses not to be self-destructive with your weapons, that has nothing to do with you turning it over to the state. You can still use it for your own self-defense against your real enemies. And your real enemies aren't some sister or brother who lives two blocks down the road from you. Your real enemies was clear in September. All you had to do was turn on the TV and look what was taking place in New Orleans. Look at how those cops were blockading your Black grandmothers, your Black grandfathers, your kids, your sons and daughters, you and your partners from crossing over the overpass into safety, Bull Connor style. How they kept us locked in these slave ship tanks at the Coliseum and stuff. That makes it clear how they were orchestrating their violence against us. And part of the problem was you didn't have black folks who were organized and capable of defending themselves against that onslaught, which black people would have been justified in every sense of the word to do. Now, if an earthquake Sam, instead of a hurricane Sam, which hit New Orleans, took place, and all of a sudden, communications, power, transportation was severely damaged for 5 or 6 days, don't be silly enough, no one in their right mind could be silly enough to believe that these maniac cops wouldn't act just as much of a fool in this region as they did over there in New Orleans. That would be like being on a plantation. Unbelievable. Being on a plantation, and here you have a situation where someone tries to escape. The slave master catches the person, and then you and some of the other slaves turn over some of the machetes and poison you have over to the master, hoping that in this sign of good faith, he won't kill the slave that he captured for trying to escape. Of course he's gonna kill him, and then probably torture you too. But see, this is what happens when you have this code of the streets, this code of the gangster, instead of a code of the slave in revolt. You don't know what the hell is going on. You're walking in an illusion. Quit posing with these damn guns and learn what they really represent. You would never see Harriet Tubman turn over her damn guns to the slaver. Or John Parker. When John Parker became free and then he started going back in to the slave region and taking folks out Underground Railroad style, they put a warrant on him, on John Parker. And what did Parker do? Parker strapped two guns to each side of him, or a gun to each side of him, walked down the middle of the street, and if any of the slave patrol, i.e. cops, tried to arrest him, he'd take them out. Now, one would ask, why would they arrest him? Because he was an outlaw. But he was an outlaw because he was a slave in resistance. He wasn't an outlaw because he was out there robbing someone's grandmother. A slave understands that the true wrath of the state comes when you are in opposition to their system. And being a street thug and all that other posturing stuff is just playing in within the mechanism of the system. Slaves in revolt are trying to crush the system. And while we're labeled as outlaws, we understand that the laws of the state are designed to crush us. And our code says that our survivability is not based off of being slave drones to this order. I mean, this is ridiculous. But next, let's check out Crystal Barbie. She's from the California Campaign to End the Death Penalty. And let's see what she has to say about this recent killing of Tookie. Check it out.
Well, I think we're at a place right now where as devastating of a loss as it was, and I think many, many people who came out and fought for Stan's life, and you are right, it was so much bigger. I've never seen as many people out at San Quentin as I have that night, and I just want to say for the record that the media reports of 1,000 or 2,000 people are so far off base. I think it was 3 or 4 or more thousand people out there, that all of those people who fought so hard, whether they were just a community member, whether they were, a kid talking about Stan in their classes, reading his books, or whether, were active in one of the organizations, that everybody became so hopeful for Stan became, the issue became more than just a campaign to sort of, you know, get on board and fight for it, but really, I think, took over people's lives, and they became so attached to him. So I think that it is important to say that there's, you know, that loss of such a great human being, you know, really is devastating. And the phrase, don't mourn, organize, I definitely believe in it, and I think that's what we have to do. But it's also, it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to lose such a special person. And just reflecting a little bit on the movement, you know, we're, you know, the movement's building, you know, Stan is so well known, his work is so important, and this whole time, you know, we're thinking, wow, like, look at all of these things that are happening, the celebrities coming on board, the movement getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And on the one hand, you know, that was important, and we saw that as, you know, we're going to have more and more of a chance of saving this man's life. The bigger it got, I think it also raised the stakes for the state of California, that he became, with every passing day, he became more and more, you know, the next, you know, Malcolm X, more and more the next great hero. And it's,
you know, I'm going to say some stuff that many people will probably think is somewhat controversial, but there seems to be something going on from this slave's perspective that, you know, it seems to kind of consistently happen in this type of sphere, where you see many white progressives, they seem to really galvanize around the castrated black male types. I'm not talking about they don't galvanize around other icons or whatever, you know, the Chomskys or whatever. But the black males that are castrated, this seems to really be the ones that all this super attention and over-infatuation with seem to take place. You know, the Tookies, Kevin Coopers, Mumia, Gary Graham. You have all types of black males who are not trapped within the dungeons of this system, who are just as developed or talented or whatever, you know, and committed, like a Fred Hampton Jr., who's been grinding for years, but who's not in the dungeon. But you don't see that type of support for a cat like that, who's not castrated. When I say castrated, I mean basically you're just locked up. You can't reproduce. You can't really have the type of, obviously, normal contact with the outside world. You're contained. You're caged and stuff. It just seems like something is going on when you have cats who are trying to and are reaching the little Tookies who are not in the gangster mode and who are not in the redemption mode. They're just at the crossroads. So they're there at the crossroads. You have these cats who are meeting them to help guide, but there only seems to be this galvanizing around the Tookies once they go the gangster route, implode in self-destruction, and then go through some kind of redemption song. Now, the history of the black experience, this is nothing really new as far as one going through some kind of redemption song. I'm talking about, you know, a percentage of those who have gone off path. George Jackson, of course, was in a self-destructive mode until, you know, he was in the same penitentiary, got killed in the same penitentiary. When he went through his redemption, in a sense, in other words, a re-examination of his life, himself, the world, and all of that, of course, if you do that honestly, you're going to be in conflict with the state, because you see that the machinery of the state is in conflict with your existence. So at that point, that's where things imploded out. At the same time, what happened at the same institution? George Jackson, Soledad brother, former Panther, killed. Malcolm, before he was Malcolm, he was Detroit Red. He went through his redemption song. Audubon Ballroom, assassination by the state with the help of the Nation of Islam. So, my whole point is that this galvanizing, here you have thousands of young black kids who are at the crossroads, and there's a machine that's trying to destroy them and send them on a self-destructive path. And the machine has various mechanisms: gentrification, spatial deconcentration, police abuse, and all of that. Why wait until a large percentage of them are in this self-destructive mode and then go through some transformation before the support? If one really wants to change this overall situation, one would think one would be interested in attacking these issues forthrightly before it reaches this very vulnerable stage that these brothers like Kevin Cooper and Tukey and others find themselves in. From 1776 to 1992, the U.S. Empire incarcerated its first million. From 1992 to 2005, that short of time, it's incarcerated its next million. It's clear what's going on. This machinery is using the subjugation of the masses of people as a mechanism of control. It's time we take control of our own destinies as slaves and go in full throttle revolt. Hold on a sec.
Tried to do is just find out what the courts themselves think about the death sentences that our capital punishment system has been imposing over the course of 23 years across 28 to 34 states, depending upon which stage of the process we were looking at. And what we found out was that in the three-stage inspections, and this is state judges, federal judges, trial judges, appellate judges, everybody who was looking at these death sentences was finding incredible amounts of error. When you add it up, it turns out that upon full inspection, over two-thirds, almost 7 out of 10 of every death sentence imposed in this country over that almost quarter century period was found to be seriously flawed in a way that undermined the reliability or trustworthiness of that death sentence and had to be done over again. Put this in a little bit of perspective. Think of this as an airline instead of a death penalty system that we're flying here. And think of if you had, you know, the airline inspecting its equipment before it took off from the runway, and if they had to take 40% of their airplanes off the tarmac in the first inspection, then 10% of the remaining, and then 40% of the still remaining planes, leaving only 32 of their original 100 planes to fly, you might say, you know, well, gee, we caught all of those errors. But I think anybody in their right mind would say that's not an airline that I want to use. And the people on the 32 planes that have supposedly been cleared to fly, when they know how many errors have been found in all the other planes, including 40% at the last inspection, I think would say the last place in the world they want to be is on the 32 planes that are supposedly cleared to fly. Yet that's the kind of death penalty system we're flying right now. And we know that some of the cases that get through the system and are cleared of error actually turn out to be cases of people who are literally innocent of the capital crime, but the system of detecting that error is so overwhelmed by all of the error that it can't catch them all. So Anthony Porter in Illinois, everybody, all of the courts that looked at his case said overwhelming evidence of guilt. Turns out he didn't commit the crime, somebody else confessed.
what would
have here is almost 25 years worth of cases. This system has been stable for decades. Our data goes up to 1995. We have looked at the trends that were happening up to and after 1995, and what we see is because of the Anti-Terrorism Act passed by Congress in 1996, the federal courts are probably doing somewhat less error detection, but it looks like the state courts are actually picking up some of the slack, and so the error rate may have come down because of less error detection from 68% to maybe 60%. But 60% error, is that something we're confident of, we're happy about? Even after we've tried to hamper and handcuff some of the inspectors so they can't catch error as well, I don't think that that modest change ought to change our view of the real implications of all of this error in the system. What we find is that there is tremendous pressure when a case is identified as a capital case to make that capital charge stick. If a prosecutor charges capitally and doesn't get the capital sentence, and of course the conviction, that's perceived as a loss. It's a blot on their record, on their reputation. And the community feels like it's not protected because it's been declared a capital case. And so the prosecutor, has a lot of incentive to win the case. Our adversarial system says, well, that's okay. The prosecutor tries to win. You get a good defense lawyer. The defense lawyer tries to win. You put them together, and the truth will come out. The real problem is that the opposition to the prosecutor is so weak because the defense lawyers are paid so little and are, for that reason, not qualified lawyers. By and large, they're very young. They're people on drugs, people on alcohol, people with disciplinary records who can't get any other work, so they're willing to work for the very small wages that you get in these cases. So you've got a very determined opponent on one side who might cut a few corners here and there in order to get the outcome that he or she wants, and nobody on the other side to catch them, and that mixture is a very, very dangerous mixture of real strong desire to get somewhere that maybe is not where we should be going, and no one on the other side of the case to try and hold that back in any real way.
Living in the Philadelphia ghettos of Latinos and African Americans, after pursuing a direct appeal 6 years later, on February 17th of 2000, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court awarded me a new trial on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. When we began the retrial, new counsel discovered that there was an eyewitness to the shooting who originally told the police during one of the proceedings in the first trial that I was not the person who he'd seen shoot his friend and brother of the sister who he was dating at the time of the murder. After hearing this new evidence, the jury believed them and decided to find me not guilty on all charges. What's so outrageous about it is that the prosecutor knew the identity of this eyewitness. The police knew of the identity of this eyewitness. They both spoke to this eyewitness previously, prior to the first trial, and yet they were willing to oppose a new trial and continue to conceal the identity of this eyewitness who who apparently exonerated him. I've been profiled to death. I was convicted to death.
Justice, black misery, the legal and illegal lynching of a people, the past and current realities of the U.S. government's state-sponsored legal executions and lynchings by racist white mobs of black people is an American tradition. What we find in this tradition is a tradition of terror. What we also find are strong similarities in state-sponsored murders and racist mob murders. For example, often the truth doesn't matter. Often, true justice of one's rights doesn't matter. Just the bloodlust of a violent racist nation that stands firm in the air of all of its hypocrisy. New York Times, June 11, 1900, an innocent man lynched. A mob willfully and knowingly hanged and burned an innocent man, as well as another who was probably innocent, near Mississippi City. Between midnight and 1 o'clock this morning, the lynching was the result of the impatience on the part of the people of Biloxi, a nearby town, over the failure of the officers of the law to produce the man who a week ago murdered Christina Winterstein, a schoolgirl who was returning to her home near Biloxi after attending the commencement exercises of her school. The crime was an unusually atrocious one, even for outrages of this nature, and naturally, suspicion turned to some unknown Negro as the perpetrator. Many arrests were made, and two of the suspects, Askew and Russ, were placed in a Mississippi City jail for safekeeping. The proof against neither was more than remotely circumstantial, and in the case of Askew, the district attorney made an examination and practically declared the men innocent. The next night, Askew was taken from a jail by a mob, tortured with fire to extort a confession. After the terrible ordeal, the mob virtually declared the man guiltless as they returned him to jail yesterday. The district attorney at a public meeting at Biloxi obtained a pledge from the citizens not to molest the prisoner if they were returned for examination. It is stated on good authority that he thought the men could prove their innocence, and the citizens were aware of this view. Some refused to pledge themselves, and yesterday afternoon it was openly asserted that it was out of the question to think of postponing the matter any longer, as the crime merited a lynching. Last night, a crowd went to the jail, secured Askew and Russ, hanged them, fired into their bodies, and built a fire under them. That was then. This is now. From 1981 to the end of 2005, the attempted lynching of Mumia Abu-Jamal When Jamal's former lawyer, Jackson, hit the stand a while back during Jamal's appeals process in 1995, Jackson testified that he didn't want to be Jamal's lawyer during the original trial because he was ill-prepared and ill-financed, financed less than $4,000 during the original trial. He had himself removed, but the judge, Judge Sable, the state's head henchman, ordered Jackson back. Jamal's former lawyer related how the coroner's department, the police, and the prosecution withheld evidence in which Jackson said showed that the bullet that killed the cop that Mumia was convicted of killing was a .44 caliber out of a .44 gun. Mumia's gun that he carried with him while he drove his taxi at night was a .38. Jackson then stated that Sable then removed a black juror and allowed a white juror to sit in who admitted that he was antagonistic against Jamal. At that point, during the appeals testimony, Judge Sable, who was also residing over the appeals hearing, stopped Jackson in mid-testimony stating that he had to go out and get a sandwich. In other words, I'm sick of hearing the facts of the probable innocence of Jamal. Let's just lynch this nigga. If Sable and the FOP had it their way, Mumia's case would have probably worked out like this. New York record held, July 24th, 1900, lynched before trial. Elijah Clark, a Negro 20 years old, was lynched at 2 o'clock this afternoon by an immense mob of citizens of Huntsville and surrounding counties. Clark was about to be removed from the Madison County Jail to the courthouse for a preliminary hearing, when the mob compelled the officers to give him up, took him to the scene of his crime, hanged him, and riddled the body with bullets. That was then. This is now. In 1995, it appears that many people involved and claim that they were listening to the OJ criminal trial, including some of the victim's family members, would have preferred the Elijah Clark way, lynched before trial. Then, of course, there's the classic, find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro. Chicago Record Hill, July 15th, 1903, rape victim witness lynching of attacker. Ed Kloss, a Negro, was lynched near here tonight while his victim, Miss Susie Johnson, was looking on. Kloss was captured after being chased through 7 counties by 50 farmers. Kloss attacked Miss Johnson last Thursday as she was returning from a small school where she teaches. The Negro kept her prisoner for several hours and she was found next morning by a searching party. A posse was organized and the Negro was trailed from here almost to Savannahan before he was overtaken. He was brought here tonight by his captors and taken to the home of Miss Johnson. The young woman identified him, and when asked what she wanted done with him, she said, quote, he ought to be killed, unquote. The Negro was then taken to a tree, and the members of the mob fired at him until he was literally cut into pieces. Chicago Record Herald, July 27, 1903. Wrong man lynched as rapist. Several days ago, a man supposed to be Ed Kloss was lynched near Eastman, Georgia, for assaulting Miss Susie Johnson, a young school teacher. The Negro protested he was not Kloss and asked for time to prove his statement. But the mob was merciless. It now transpires that the Negro was not Kloss and had never seen Miss Johnson. Kloss, who assaulted the girl, has been located near Dorange, Georgia, and officers passed through here tonight to secure him. It is believed that Kloss will be taken from the officers and lynched. New York Age, April 30th, 1914, was powerless to aid sister who was raped and lynched. The brother of a young colored girl who was lynched by a mob of white ruffians near Wagner, Oklahoma a few weeks ago, passed through this town on his way to Mexico. He gave a pathetic account of the lynching to colored citizens here. The young man's sister was but 17 years old and of respectable parents. Two half-drunken white men walked into their home during the absence of the mother and found the girl dressing, locked themselves into her room, and criminally assaulted her. The scream for help were heard by her brother, who, kicking down the door, went to rescue her in defending his sister. He shot one of the brutes. The other escaped. Later in the evening, the local authorities, failing to find the brother, arrested the sister. Find a Negro. Any Negro. Lynch a Negro. The sister, who was taken from jail by a mob at 4 o'clock in the morning, and lynched. From his hiding place, the brother, who was 21 years old, could hear his sister's cry for help, but was powerless to aid her. That was then. This is now. In 1980, a 16-year-old white girl named Cheryl D. Ferguson was raped and murdered. The suspicion of the murderer turns to the school's 5 janitors. One of the school's janitors later testified that the cops looked at Clarence Bradley, the only black janitor, and said, quote, "Since you're the nigger, you're elected," unquote. Bradley was later convicted and sentenced to death by an all-white jury. It was later found that the prosecution intentionally suppressed evidence of Bradley's innocence and had their witnesses perjure themselves during the trial. After a tremendous battle, all charges were dropped and Bradley was set free after spending 10 years in jail in this travesty of justice. One's innocence doesn't always matter. Often just the color of one's skin. Even the presiding judge in Bradley's appeals case admitted as much. Quote, "The court unequivocally concludes that the color of Clarence Bradley's skin was a substantial factor that pervaded all aspects of the state's capital prosecution of him," unquote. In other words, white justice, black misery. But not all of the convicted innocent get off so lucky. Take the case of Lionel Herrera. America's white light of justice shines horribly clear. The nephew of the true murderer came forward stating that he witnessed his uncle kill this person. His uncle then turned to him and threatened to kill him if he ever said anything. The nephew, who was not in his teens at the time, complied with his uncle's threats. But after many years had passed, the nephew, now a young adult, stepped forward with the truth. Herrera's attorneys presented this and other strong new evidence revealing Herrera's probable innocence. The attorneys asked for the case to be reopened to prevent the ultimate miscarriage of justice, the execution of an innocent person. The Department of Justice countered, stating that since Herrera had a fair trial, quote-unquote, the first time, and was violently sentenced, quote-unquote, the new evidence supporting Herrera's claim of innocence was, quote, irrelevant, unquote. The Supreme Court agreed and rejected Herrera's appeals to reopen his case. Herrera, a most probable innocent person, was executed. Once again, white justice, black, wait, hold on. In this case, brown misery, which should come as a good lesson for other persons of colors in this society, some of whom think they can slide by. Sam nearly exterminated the red from this hemisphere, dropped the bomb on the yellow, and is 187 in brown from their own land. And well, white justice, black misery, we know what he's doing to black. The Supreme Court has ruled that the condemned prisoners who have exhausted their appeals have no constitutional rights on having their cases being heard by the federal courts, even when evidence supports their innocence. What the courts are saying, in effect, is that if the states follow its laws and procedures, even if these laws and procedures are racist, sexist, and biased against the poor, then that's a fair trial, and you can be executed on that basis, guilty or not. White justice, black misery. Even if one's mental facility, though, are not quite there, it doesn't matter to a lawless, brutal government and its lawless, racist mob of terror. Montgomery Advertiser, August 25th, 1913. Negro halfwit lynch threatened to lynch whites. Deputy Sheriff David Kennerbrook today reported the lynching of Wilson Gardner, a young Negro halfwit who was found Sunday by hanging from a belt. Gardner had gone around to the homes of white miners near Kilgore carrying a rope threatening to hang them. This disturbed the miners, who beat the half-wit to death before hoisting his corpse to a railroad trestle. That was then. This is now. In 1992, Bill Clinton signed the papers to have lobotomized half-wit Ricky Ray Rector put to death. Rector was in such a lost and poor mental state that when they came to take him to his execution table, he asked them to save his pecan pie because he liked to eat it before he went to bed at night. And as they were strapping him down to destroy him, he commented on how he was going to vote for the then presidential candidate Bill Clinton. Clinton himself flew back to Arkansas to witness this execution. One must ask, what has truly changed? Certainly not white justice, black misery, for it is in our hands to change this madness. For those in power are not looking for true justice, this justice American style. A while back, executioner former President Bill Clinton passed his own crime bills, Part 1 and 2, and the Effective Death Penalty, and Anti-Terrorism Act, which really means, ain't I the terrorist? Yes, Bill, you are. For in those bills, it reduces the number of appeals one is allowed after they are convicted. But in a staff report issued on October 21, 1993 by the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights called Innocence and the Death Penalty, it documented 48 persons who have been released from prison since 1993 after strong evidence and agitation for their release was won. Now that release of innocence is over 120. Many of these innocent inmates would have probably been destroyed if Clinton's bill of crime had been passed while they were in prison fighting for their appeals. That's the crime, Bill. That the death penalty is not designed for justice, but rather as a terror weapon leashed out on the masses. The crime Bill and his supporters of death ignore is that the fact that there are large numbers of innocent known persons who have been executed over the last few decades. But that's just it. The legal and illegal lynching has never been about true justice, but about the violent terror of control used to suppress its desired targets. That, in America's capitalist system, translates to, amongst all other things, to white justice, black misery. This has been Tracy James with a commentary. White justice, black misery. The legal and illegal lynching of a people. Out. And on Slave Revolt, we're out too. Until the next time, Slave Out. Thank you.